Welcome to the show, Fairways in Finance. My name is Jeff Smith. I've been in the mortgage business for 16 years, top 0.25% LO nationwide. And you know, this podcast, we want to talk about your finances, how to grow and accumulate wealth, and all things related to the mortgage industry. But we're golf lovers here as well. So we're going to work in some golf. Don't worry for my golf lovers out there. We got you. And I hope you enjoy the show. Hey guys, if you enjoyed this episode today, please share it with anybody who's in your network. I'm working hard to grow this podcast and depend on referrals from the audience like you. And would greatly appreciate you helping me to spread the word and build my brand. If there's somebody who comes to mind, leave us a 5-star review. That goes a long way in helping to grow the brand as well. Enjoy. All right, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Glad you're here. Hope you're having a great week. Let's talk about the market, and specifically, let's talk about what is the difference between today's market versus 2007. Because in 2008, we had the Great Recession, and you know, anybody alive today was impacted by that some way, either directly or indirectly. And it was a devastating event. Like, so many people lost their jobs, people lost a ton of equity in their home. It was a financial crisis, you know, of a humongous magnitude. It was the second worst financial crisis in the history of the country. And I actually think that's the first most important thing to understand is we're talking about the second worst financial crisis in the history of the U.S. So the only thing that we've gone through as a country that's been worse than that was the Great Depression in the early 1900s. So keep that context in mind, because events like that are very rare, you know, and it's a generational event. We hope that we're lucky enough to not live through something like that again. You know, however, the scar tissue is there, and it's something that everybody's thinking about today because prices have run up. And prices ran up during the bubble leading up to the 2008 crash. And so people now want to equate what's happening today with what happened in 2008, but it's completely different circumstances and a completely different market. So let's talk about what's different today versus 2007. So first of all, 2007 is when we hit the peak of the bubble, and there were at the middle of 2007, there was 3.4 million homes for sale. Today, there are about 900,000 homes for sale. So less than one third the amount of inventory, and the number of households is higher today than it was in 2007. So even if the number of households were still the same, it's less than a third of the total inventory. But taking into account the number of households being a larger number today than 2007, that's even more. You know, so we have a fraction of the number of homes for sale today that we had back then. And the what drives home prices is just supply and demand. That's it. So when there is more demand than there is supply, then supply and demand economics pushes prices higher. And when there's oversupply, then we see prices go down. And so in 2007, we reached a point of oversupply. And we actually, going into 2008, that's when we were really at an oversupply versus demand. You know, so that's the first thing to understand about this market that we're in today. And what's been driving home prices is a lack of supply. And so in 2007, leading up to that, you know, we had all these homes for sale. And the run up into 2007, you know, really starting from like early 2000s, was a over time loosening of lending guidelines. And so loosening of lending practices led to a lot of bad loans that were being originated from, you know, 03 to 07. So we had, you know, the stated income, stated asset loans, which is like the craziest thing. You just literally state your income, state your assets, and then we'd approve you for a loan. So I can remember when I first got in the business, that was 2006 is when I started in the business. And so we used to have this, like we run a underwriting system called a automated underwriting system. And it's a computer system that basically tells you if the loan's approved or not. So if there were certain parameters on the loan, we would get an approval that would say straight to close, It's like straight to close. Yes. And it literally meant we were going straight to closing. So all I had to do was input an application based on verbal income and assets from the borrower. And then the loan was approved, signed, stamped, delivered, and we'd send it to closing and the buyer could go sign. And so you could literally just come in and tell me, yeah, Jeff, I got 200 G's in the bank and I make, let's see, 20 grand a month. I don't know. And I'd be like, okay, great. And I'd write it down and then straight to close, you're approved. And then we go to closing. So there wasn't verification of anything on those types of loans. You know, and those weren't the only loans being done then, but they were prevalent. So lack of verification, a lack of skin in the game. So there were a lot of programs where there was no money down. And there were even stated income programs with no money down. So if somebody has no down payment, they don't have any skin in the game. If they go into foreclosure or default on that loan, they're not losing the down payment money that they invested when they closed on the home. So they're less incentivized to stick with the mortgage if they run into any kind of financial challenges. When you put zero down, you can walk away from that home and you haven't lost any money because you didn't put anything down. You've got damaged credit, but you don't have that skin in the game. So there was a lot of no money down programs. There was the rise of quote unquote subprime loans. So subprime loans were loans for people who didn't have good enough credit to qualify for a regular mortgage. And they were at higher rates, higher fees. And we were approving people for loans with very little down again, which is the problem. And it was very little down and very little skin in the game for people who were a greater credit risk. So subprime loans were really prevalent and not responsibly originated and led to defaults on mortgages. And then, you know, another one that I think was really the biggest factor in this whole thing is a product called an option arm. So option arms are a loan where you have three options for the type of payment you're going to make. First option is a regular principal and interest payment. Second option is an interest-only payment. And then in door number three, magic door number three, which was the naughty door, that was a payment that didn't even cover the interest on the loan. So door number three, when you make that payment, your mortgage balance is going up every month because you're not even paying the interest that's due on the loan. So you give an average consumer a option arm, which payment do you think they're going to make? They're going to make the smallest payment, which is option number three. And so there were a whole bunch of people who had option arms. They had put no money down. They're making a payment that's not even covering the interest due on the loan, and their mortgage balance is going up. Those loans had a introductory period of 3 to 5 years for a lot of them. And after that 3 to 5 years, the loan would reset to a principal and interest payment. So you would go from making payment option number three to all of a sudden being required to make payment option number one. And your mortgage payment would almost double to go from option three to option one. So a lot of these loans were given out to people in 03 or 02, 03, 04. And if you add 5 years on top of that, then you get to 07, 08, 09, when these option arms were resetting. So those were kind of like the canary in the coal mine, because as those option arms began to reset, you had a whole bunch of people who'd been paying, you know, $1,500 a month, and now all of a sudden their mortgage is $3,500 a month, and they could barely afford the $1,500 a month. So their mortgage goes to $3,500, and they've got to sell. And so all these people started needing to list their home. Speculative demand. This was another symptom of lending practices that were too loose. So it was easy to get non-owner occupied loans. So you could buy investment properties with a low amount down, second homes with a low amount down. And so, we started to get into the bubble, 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, values start really rapidly rising in 04 and 05, you saw a lot of people buying homes that they never intended to move into. So they were speculative buys. They would hold the loan for 6 months and hold the property for 6 months. A lot of times not even renting it out, just literally holding it and then flipping it for $50,000 profit because home values were rising so fast. And because you could do stated income loans, it was easy for people to pick up a bunch of these properties. So what happened was you got all these speculative purchases happening, creating a lot of transactions, driving prices higher, but it's not a real demand because it's people buying multiple homes that they have no intent in living in, but just creating a lot of transactions, which runs up the prices. So it creates demand. And if you have a lot of demand and not enough supply, that pushes prices higher, but it wasn't a real demand. It was a speculative demand. And then non-owner-occupied transactions. So a non-owner-occupied transaction, you know, is a property that you don't live in. If you compare non-owner-occupied, non-owner-occupied transactions increased from 20% of the market in the year 2000 to 35% of the market in 2006. So that goes hand in hand with that speculative demand. A lot more non-owner occupied purchases, and that's creating this false demand, which is pushing prices higher. So you take all of these things together, speculative demand, bad loans being originated, no skin in the game, and then you throw in the poison pill of the option arm. And as these option arms began to reset, what do you think these people did? They put their home on the market to try and sell it. And then the media caught wind of all these option arms resetting. And the media started reporting, hey, there's this increase of option arms resetting that people can't afford, and there might be a problem. And now all of a sudden, you get investors in Wall Street wanting to sell. And so Wall Street was heavily invested in all of these mortgages. So as these option arms are resetting, more and more people are listing their homes for sale, pushing supply higher, higher, higher. Well, as the supply of the number of homes for sale goes up, sellers have to lower their price to attract a buyer because now we have an oversupply versus demand. So sellers have to start cutting prices to try and entice a buyer to purchase. So that's bringing the value of homes down, down, down. More option arms are resetting. Prices are going down. Now option arms are resetting. People can't sell their home because it's sitting on the market. They can no longer afford to make the payment. They're going into foreclosure. So now you've got this increase of foreclosures and short sales, and then we're off to the races. You know, so now you've got Wall Street crumbling because, you know, companies like Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, they were heavily invested in mortgage-backed securities. So their holdings were defaulting in a rapid pace because they were heavily invested in option arms, you know, in these loans that are going into foreclosure on Main Street. So this whole thing, this snowball just starts tumbling and it creates more inventory that piles up, the more prices have to go down. And that's why home prices fell. So in 2008, you know, from the peak of 2007 to what we saw in the next year and a half leading into 2009, you know, home prices fell on average by 33% across the country. So 33% decline, a meltdown of Wall Street. And it was all of these things that were tied together that led to it, with the option arm being the poison pill. Okay, so that's 2007. Fast forward to today, 2022. We've got 900,000 homes for sale versus 3.4 million homes for sale in the peak of 2007. We have a severe undersupply of available homes. Well, why do we have undersupply? We have undersupply for a few different reasons. One, builders are not able to build enough homes to keep pace with demand. And this has been going on predating COVID. You know, there's been a supply issue for 6-7 years now. And builders are having trouble building enough homes for a few reasons. One, they aren't able to get enough labor to build homes fast enough. So the average plumber, electrician, roofer, they tend to be of the baby boomer generation. So they're that of that age. And a lot of them have gotten out of the business and retired. You know, and a lot of builders in that 08 crash got wiped out and never went back into business. They went into some other industry. A lot of tradespeople who worked for those builders when they got wiped out left the real estate industry and went into some other kind of industry. So, and then we've got immigration. The U.S. has clamped down on immigration a lot over the last, you know, 5, 6 years, 7, 10 years. And, you know, I'm not saying whether that's good or bad, but it's a reality. And a lot of immigrants work those labor type of positions. So between the age of the average tradesperson, lower immigration, builders have trouble getting enough labor to build homes fast enough to keep pace with demand. Millennials, that generation of people is now coming of age to where they can afford to buy a home. So millennials represent the largest eligible group of home buyers ever in the U.S. So there's a ton of people who are eligible or at a place financially where they can look at a home purchase. So there's lots of demand. And then builders are having trouble getting enough land to build cost-effective housing. So as prices go up, builders need to be able to build homes that are closer together on smaller parcels of land to keep the cost down and to build affordable housing. Well, there's a lot of red tape in most states to split parcels of land and rezone land to get it into parcels that are cost effective for builders and developers to create affordable housing. So dealing with the various municipalities across the country, so much red tape there, it makes it really hard for builders to gobble up the land that they need to be able to build affordable housing. So, you know, we've got a lack of labor, we've got a large pool of buyers who want to buy, and we've got difficulty getting the land needed for builders to build affordable housing, and that's creating a lack of inventory. And then today, you know, looking at the lending practices that have been in place since 2010, lending standards got completely revamped in 2010. So we had a bill called Dodd-Frank. It was a sweeping financial regulation package. It completely changed many of the requirements for mortgage companies and how mortgages get originated. It created a designation of what's called a qualified mortgage. So a qualified mortgage meets a set of parameters, like responsible lending parameters, that make a loan more likely to succeed. You know, so like no interest only payments and a 30-year amortization and income and assets are verified, these types of things. So when a loan is considered a qualified mortgage, the lender is protected from getting sued from a consumer for malpractice. So what happened, you know, during the crash is some lenders got sued for originating loans they shouldn't have originated. And that created financial liability and risk for the lenders. This QM, qualified mortgage designation, was put in place to incentivize lenders to originate responsible loans. And the incentive was that they get shielded from malpractice suits if they underwrote the loan and closed it as a qualified mortgage. So now, you know, in today's world, you've got to put money down. You've got to provide all of your paperwork to verify your income and your assets. We basically get every document you have plus a blood sample and maybe a firstborn child, maybe a secondborn, depending on how complicated your situation is. But we're doing a very thorough job analyzing people's ability to repay a loan and requiring that they put money down. And then most recently, the Treasury Department renegotiated their deal with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And as part of that negotiated deal, required Fannie and Freddie to reduce their number of second home and non-owner occupied transactions to 7% of their total portfolio. So there, even just this year, it was at the end of last year, we've seen additional regulation to make sure that we don't have speculative demand that runs away and is artificially inflating home prices. So today, we have rising prices because of a lack of inventory, and the lack of inventory, you know, is the reasons that we just discussed. And there aren't there isn't the poison pill of bad loans out there that are going to blow up the market. So as we move forward here with this, we will continue to see home prices rise until there is enough supply to balance out with demand. And it's going to take a while for those things to balance themselves out. Now, we have rising rates. So interest rates have risen over a point and a half so far this year. We have the highest inflation we've had since the early 1980s. And so the rising rates, as rates continue to move higher, it makes the cost of owning a home more expensive. And as the cost of owning a home is more expensive, it's going to discourage people from wanting to buy. And we're already starting to see the data come out to show that there's less buyer interest, less buyer demand for home purchases at this point in the year than there was at the beginning of the year due to higher rates. So that higher rate environment is helping to slow down the market. And what we're expecting going forward, starting in May, is that the Fed is going to aggressively hike interest rates. And mortgage rates are most closely or mortgage rates are most heavily influenced by inflation. So we have the highest inflation we've had since the early 80s, which is why rates are rising quickly. As the Fed begins to raise short-term rates, that's their tool for capping inflation. So Fed raises short-term rates. It makes borrowing costs more expensive for banks and businesses and consumers. That slows down economic activity, which then slows down inflation. And so that's, you know, eventually going to push the country into a recession. So we've seen some indicators that show that the country is likely to go into a recession in the next 12 months. We've had what's called an inversion of the yield curve. So when the 10-year treasury is paying a lower rate of interest than the 2-year treasury, we've seen that happen 5 times in the last 30 years. And each time that's happened, we've gone into a recession on average 11 months after that inversion. So the yield curve inverted at the beginning of April. So that indicates that it's likely we'll be in a recession sometime in the next 12 months or so. So we're going to, this high increase in home prices is going to start to slow down because rates have risen so much. And now the Fed is going to put the brakes on the economy and they're going to put us into a recession. But a recession does not mean like a market-wide crash like we had in 2008. On average, we go into a recession every 4 years. We have had very few recessions over the last 15 years, but it's not necessarily a market-wide epic crash. A recession is just two fiscal quarters in a row of negative GDP. So that's, we're likely to see that, and that's going to put the brakes on home price appreciation. It's going to put the brakes on the economy for a period of time. And what we generally see happen during a recession is interest rates come down, because then the government has to start to cut rates to spur economic activity again and get things ramped back up. We kind of just always go through these boom and bust cycles. So that's what we're expecting, but we're not expecting home prices to go down, because even with a recession, that does not solve the inventory problem that we have. The inventory problem that we have is related to those factors I mentioned before, and it's going to take a while for those things to work themselves out. I kind of think what we're going to have to see happen is the price of new homes is going to have to increase significantly for builders to be able to pay more to laborers to incentivize more laborers to join those trades types of positions, because younger people are graduating college at a higher rate than they ever have before. Fewer younger people are going into those trades positions. So builders are going to have to do something to get more labor. And there's also going to have to be some kind of reckoning with municipalities to get more land available for builders to build. So that those are the reasons why I don't see home prices crashing or going way down. I definitely do see a slowdown in home price appreciation. Like Phoenix, most recent numbers, is going up at a rate of 33% year over year. That's just not sustainable over the long term. At some point, it's going to pull back to that more average 3-5% year over year, which is what we typically see from real estate. Let's talk just a little bit. I want to explain, and this kind of helps to explain 2007. I want to explain how mortgage rates are determined and how that flow of the money works. So when a mortgage company originates a loan, like most of the loans we originate get sold to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or they're insured by Ginnie Mae. And those Fannie and Freddie, they're government-sponsored enterprises. So they're independent private companies. But in 08, the federal government bought like 97% of their stock. So the feds basically own Fannie and Freddie, but they're technically independent organizations. But they have an implicit government guarantee that the government will not allow them to fail and go bankrupt. So what happens when a mortgage company like ours originates a loan? We fund the loan with our own money. So we use what are called warehouse lines to fund the loan. So there are these humongous lines of credit that are multiple hundreds of millions of dollars. And when we close the loan, we wire money off of that line of credit, off that warehouse line, to the title company for the loan. As we close loans, we package them together and sell them to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And Fannie and Freddie buy those loans from us. The difference between what the loan is priced at and what Fannie and Freddie pay for the loan, that's the profit that we earn on the transaction. And then Fannie and Freddie take those loans and they pool them together and sell them to Wall Street as mortgage-backed securities, MBS. So those loans are pooled and invested into all kinds of mutual funds and different investment portfolios that you might have in your 401k or IRA or stock portfolio. Mortgage-backed securities are in a lot of different kinds of investments. So the money, goes from the mortgage company to Fannie and Freddie, then to Wall Street. Or if it's a jumbo loan, we close the jumbo loan, fund it with our own money, sell it directly to a bank. And then the banks, the secondary markets haven't opened up yet to where the banks are selling those loans to Wall Street. So a jumbo loan, a bank would hold on their balance sheet. But over time, that market will open up and banks will then sell their loans to Wall Street as well. So that's why in 2007, in 2008, when we went through the crash, companies like Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, they immediately went bankrupt because they were heavily invested in mortgage-backed securities. And when those loans went into default, then they lost a ton of money and it took them down almost instantly. So that's the flow of the money, and that's how the industry works and is all connected together. So I would love to answer any questions you have on that. Please feel free to reach out to me, direct message, shoot me an email. Always happy to help, and I hope you have a great rest of your week. Hey guys, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show and got some valuable information out of it. I want to help to educate others and help people grow their business and build wealth. And I can only do that with referrals and your help getting the word out about this podcast. So if you come across someone you think could benefit from this, please share it with them and would love to help them as well. And if there's nobody who comes to mind, a 5-star review would go a long way in helping me to grow this podcast and grow the brand. So appreciate your support.